You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Due to technical difficulties, part of this talk is missing.
We have a lovely session now, which I'm hoping is what you're here for, which is Tax the Rich, Dream On. And I'm going to hand over to Sally Foster-Fulton from Christian Aid, who will be chairing this panel.
Thank you. And good morning, you incredibly intrepid Greenbelters. I am Sally Foster-Fulton. I'm the UK and Global Churches Ambassador for Christian Aid, and I'm really excited to be part of this group at the No Fly Zone. As we were saying, it's the first time that we've been able to open up our dialogue and discussion beyond this festival field and be joined by speakers from outside the UK. And over this weekend, we've already had speakers joining us from Australia, from Jamaica, from the Dominican Republic, from Switzerland. And over the rest of the weekend, we'll hear from friends in the United States, in Uganda, and South Africa. And today on our panel, we'll be hearing from Mohammed Adao from PowerShift Africa. Mohammed, where are you calling us from today?
Garissa in northern Kenya.
All right. Welcome. We're so glad you're here with us. Each day, we are exploring different areas of Christian Aid's work, from racial to economic justice. And today, we are getting to grips with economic justice and that thorny issue of tax. I remember a friend of mine wrote a report, and he titled it The Joy of Tax. Mm-hmm. Nobody got it. Didn't figure it out. Our friends at Oxfam have recently reported that the richest 1% have amassed $42 trillion in new wealth over the past decade. That's nearly 34 times more than the entire bottom 50% of the world's population. And this comes at a time when income and wealth inequality is rising in many countries.
In what I'm saying to you in the talk, we can go into more detail in Q&A. Taxes, as I've said, raise revenue, help us to redistribute income, and can be used to pay for things like public services, social safety nets, environmental protections, and so on. So first of all, let's think about that as individuals. Do we pay our own taxes responsibly, on time, without grumbling, without seeking ways to avoid them? What about the businesses we engage with, whether as individuals or organisations, churches or business or our own workplace? Where do we shop? Do we know what they're doing, if they're paying their fair share of taxes too? And then the system, which is what I mainly want to focus on. Is the system in line with those values that I've spoken about? Does it give everyone the chance to flourish? Does it care for the vulnerable? Does it protect our natural spaces? Tax policy, then, in terms of taxing the rich, so particularly thinking about taxing the wealth of individuals more in order to do this, could include some changes to the existing system. We could look at equalising capital gains and income tax, for example. That could raise over £15 billion a year. We could apply national insurance. That's a tax at the moment on income, but it could be applied to investment income as well, not just work. That could raise over £8 billion a year. There are loopholes in inheritance tax that benefit the already wealthy. That could raise over £1 billion a year if we close those loopholes. And we've had some changes to what we call non-dom rules about where people stay. There's is their place of residence for the purposes of paying tax. And we could close those. We could change those further to raise even more revenue. On top of those changes to existing taxes that are already there, at the Just Money Movement, we've been campaigning for a specific wealth tax. So, for example, that's a tax on all asset classes of wealth. That could be a 2% wealth tax on assets over £10 million, which has been estimated could raise over £20 billion in revenue a year. That's just affecting the top 0.04% 0.04% of the population in the UK. So tiny numbers of people raising billions of pounds for revenue and tackling the fact that those people who've benefited enormously in recent years from our economic model, our unequal economic model, can contribute significantly more. I want to say a tiny bit about taxing wealthy businesses, not hugely the focus of what I'm saying here today, but obviously a really important part of the pie of where tax revenue comes from. We will probably be, some of you will be familiar with the fact that Amazon, for example, paid in UK corporation tax in 2022, £0 in the UK. So how do we close these loopholes where rich multinational corporations can get away with paying little to no tax on their vast profits in the places where they're operating? There could be measures to crack down on that, to introduce globally agreed minimum corporate tax rates, to tackle tax havens, for example, as well, to tackle transparency in the tax system. And I can say more about all of that if we want to get into the detail. And then, as I say, my third point really is that because wealth is globalised and we live in a globalised world, we've got to have this conversation and cooperate across borders. So when we are talking about taking action on tax justice here in the UK, we're doing that in solidarity with people across the global majority world. And we're really, I guess, in terms of that question about the UK government, hopeful that there has been a growth in momentum around the conversation about taxing wealth more in the UK. And we're also hopeful that the UK will take more of an internationalist stance, this new government, and therefore there can be pressure applied globally as well as domestically on the UK government to take action. I'll leave it there for now.
Okay. Thank you, Sarah. And welcome back, Mohammed. We're so glad you hung on. Thank you.
Thank you.
I doubt you can hear it, but there's a lot of applause. Thank you so much for hanging on. Mohammed, I want to come to you now. You are a leading campaigner for climate justice and the need for fossil fuel companies and the world's richest economies to commit funds to pay for the damage caused by the climate crisis. What role does tax play in making that happen? Mohammed.
Sami, thanks firstly for inviting me. I've not been to Greenbelt for a few years, so it's great to be able to take part in it while sitting here in Kenya. I often speak about climate debt that is owed by the rich to the global majority. The continent that I'm in, accounts for less than 4% of the global carbon emissions. Yet, we suffer the brunt of the impact of climate change. I grew up in the part of the country where I am now, which is Garissa in the northeast of the country, and it's part of a pastoralist community. And we've seen the impact of climate breakdown. Drought is gripping, part of this region now, killing people and livestock and putting millions of people into hunger and poverty. It's also happening now in southern part of the continent, particularly in Zambia, Malawi, which are actually facing some of the worst drought they've had in over 40 years. And at the center of climate justice, and I want to emphasize on the word justice here, is a recognition that to be able to effectively address the climate crisis, those countries and people with the most responsibility for climate change and the greatest capacity to respond must do the heavy lifting to respond to the crisis. This is particularly true of those who have actually fulfilled basic needs of their population. And here we're talking about the rich polluters, the rich countries, who owe a debt to the people that have done the least. In fact, people who have actually will continue to live in complete harmony with nature, who have imprinted the lightest carbon footprint on the planet. If you look at where the debate now is, in recent years, we've made some progress in having, debt recognized. Rich countries now, have agreed to finance poorer, vulnerable countries. And last year, we actually saw the creation of the Loss and Damage Fund to compensate victims for losses and damages caused by the climate crisis. But we all know the sums that have been pledged so far are too small. And so what we need is rich countries and rich nations to do everything that is needed to actually help mobilize sufficient finance to support the vulnerable countries, adapt to the impact of climate change that are inevitable, to compensate them for the harms that have already been caused, but also help transition to a low carbon development pathway so that we can be able to live within the planetary boundaries. And so what it will take to actually help mobilize the scale of resources that are needed to help the world tackle this climate breakdown is actually tax. Tax provides us an avenue to raise the climate finance that is needed. And there are multiple paths, and you know, I missed part of the introduction, but there are multiple paths that we could take. And I'll talk about three specifically. First, we can tax the vast profits of the fossil fuel companies. Let's remember, these corporate giants are making billions in profit, especially since the war in Ukraine that pushed up the price of oil. And so it's absurd that these companies get to profit from two forms of tragedy. The first is the climate suffering that they're causing through, you know, the burning of the product that they produce. And this happens through the burning of fossil fuels. And the second is the profit that they're making from the misery of Ukrainians under the attack of Vladimir Putin. And so the way to have perhaps address this is to tax this unfair profit and use that money to properly fill the loss and damage fund. And that would be a good start, but also extend the value to support adaptation, to support the just energy transition. There are also other taxes which we could actually target. And this includes targeting polluting individuals. Here I'm putting the emphasis in polluting individuals. So if you take the example of the frequent flyer, we could introduce a frequent flyer tax, for example, that will generate income from people who make lots of, you know, flights. For example, business people who continue to rack up lots of, you know, short-haul flights for meetings, for example. So if we introduced a frequent flyer tax, you could actually use that to generate finance that supports, you know, climate actions, including loss and damage fund. We could also do a wealth tax on the richest 1%. And I think it's important for us to recognize these people are also often the biggest consumers of fossil fuels and have a disproportionate impact on the planet. You know, Oxfam has been, you know, producing good analysis, you know, about, you know, 50% of the emissions that have caused climate change are actually emitted by the richest 1%. So if we were in a position to actually tax some of their wealth and use it to elevate the impact of climate change, we'll actually begin to repay the climate debt. I think it's important with the new government in the UK, which promises a better approach on climate change than the last lot, I think we'll take this as an opportunity to make the case to use tax system to tackle the climate crisis. And I think at the heart of this call is a recognition that if we don't use tax creatively to help mobilize sufficient resources to allow the world to tackle climate change, we will not be in a position to help limit, you know, global heating to below 1.5 degrees. Why I say this is the world agreed the Paris Agreement, which brings together the rich and poor, you know, the north and south, literally all the countries of the world. And so we now have the greatest buy-in from all parties in the world. But I want to say this, participation alone in the Paris Agreement is not going to suffice. Since countries pollute at different levels and have different financial and technological capacities to deal with the climate problem, it's important for us to recognize the kind of collective effort that is needed to reduce emissions to help the world adapt to climate change will only succeed if we have fairness at its heart. And taxation is an important tool that will allow us to deal with this breakdown in a very strategic but also in an unprecedented way, both to mobilize climate action but to also mobilize climate finance so that the maintenance of a stable climate system can be realized, which we all know is a public good. So it's not just you're taxing the rich or the rich polluters. You're actually helping to safeguard a stable climate system, which is a public good. And so in our collective interest, to design a system that avoids the risk and shares, you know, the burden fairly between all people and all countries. Thank you, Sami.
Thank you so much, Mohammed. Thank you. And Pete, I'm going to come to you now. There is still a connection between tax and debt. You know, there's a report on debt across Africa revealing that paying debt comes at the expense of nurses' salaries and investment in schools. Many of us thought that we'd already secured debt cancellation. Why is that back on the agenda?
Yeah, thanks, Sally. I was going to start really by asking, actually, to the people who are here today, how many of us were in Birmingham in 1998 for the G8 summit? I can see some hands going up. Many of us at Greenbelt who would have been there in 1998, for those of you too young, perhaps not even born when that happened, there was a G8 summit when we were campaigning. Greenbelt was right at the forefront of it, and churches right across the country were campaigning for debt cancellation for heavily indebted countries. And thousands of us, tens of thousands of us, went and surrounded the G8 meeting, that meeting of global leaders in Birmingham, surrounded as a chain, calling for the chains of debt to be broken and for debt to be cancelled. And I imagine lots of people who were involved in that, probably 2 or 3 years later, when the then Chancellor, Gordon Brown, did introduce a scheme that resulted in the cancellation of debt for heavily indebted countries, probably thought that issue of debt cancellation was done. Again, I mean, I don't know how many people put their hands up and thought it was done. Yeah, a few, okay. But I guess the bad news is it was done to a certain extent, but it is back. And the debt crisis that many countries are facing right around the globe is as bad, if not worse, than it was in the 1990s. And you're right, Sally, we have to make this connection between tax justice and debt justice, because what we're seeing is inequality in many countries growing at an everly rapid rate because of debt payments. Christian Aid did a report earlier this year looking into this. And just to give you a bit of a taste of what that looks like in practice, 60% of African countries spend more now on external debt payments than they do on health and education. As Sally said, that's hospitals and nurses. And who wins from that? We've talked about them a bit before. Who wins? It's mostly private lenders. It's the big banks. It's the asset managers who win this time. Looking at some individual countries and what that looks like in practice, if you take somewhere like Malawi, in Malawi, the government spends more than three times the amount on debt payments than it does on its health services. Three times more on debt than on health. In Ethiopia, debt repayments mean that the government's unable to pay doctors and teachers. And that's meaning in Ethiopia that we're seeing hospitals closing, we're seeing schools closing. And in Kenya, debt repayments mean that social services for children have been cut. And as Mohammed talked about, there's a really important connection here with the climate crisis, because debt repayments are stopping many of these countries from spending the important money that they need to spend on loss and damage, on climate adaptation, and on climate mitigation. And the difference, I guess, this time between where we were back in the 1990s is it's not primarily countries that are holding that debt. So, you know, back in 2000, 2001, Gordon Brown, as Chancellor of the UK government, could lead countries around the globe in getting the UK and the US and others to cancel debt. This time, primarily that debt is being held with private lenders. It's the HSBCs and the JP Morgans and the BlackRocks of this world who are holding that money, who are holding these countries really to ransom, and who need to cancel that debt. And as Sarah said, you know, Christians, churches have been right at the heart of campaigns on tax justice and debt justice because we have a faith mandate to do something about this. We have a biblical mandate to do something about this. It's at the core of what we believe, the year of Jubilee and the cancellation of debt. And that's why I think once again we need to see this movement of people coming together and demanding action. What does that action look like? I think both Sarah and Mohammed have given us some really good tastes of ways that we can do that. And I guess we're thinking about that, the action that we need on tax and on debt, right at a moment when we have a new government. And I'll be perfectly honest with you, under the last government, we pretty much had zero hope of getting very much done on debt issues. But there is a window of opportunity here with this new government, and there is a bit of light because they have shown an indication already, a willingness to talk about these issues. And the UK is at right at the heart of the solution on the debt crisis, because these asset managers and these banks that we're talking about that hold this debt, where are they based? Many of them are based in the City of London. So if you are a debt campaigner in France trying to do something about this, or Germany or somewhere else, you might actually struggle to get your government to do very much about it. Of course, action needs to happen in those global spaces. But really, the UK and probably the New York institutions, you know, the New York government, etc., they are the places where we can get this done, but they're not going to do it willingly, and it's going to require legislation, and that's going to require this Labour government to do something about that. And so there are two things, really, that I think we need to be calling on the government now to do. The first one is to legislate so that these big banks, these asset managers, cancel this debt. And we can make that demand to them now. And like I say, there is interest. You know, I think our foreign secretary, longtime supporter of an organization like Christian Aid, David Lammy, committed Christian socialist. You know, I think there is hope with a foreign secretary like David Lammy that we should be able to get him to listen on this. And I think there's indications from him that he recognizes that debt is an issue. So we need to demand that the government do that. And the second thing is that we need to join the dots here between this action on debt and this action on tax. And what we need to start seeing, I think, is our UK government going into, as Sarah said, those global spaces and really demanding a new financial settlement that ensures that there's action not only on debt, but on tax, on trade, and joins the dots with these issues that we've been campaigning on as Christians, as people who care about justice for so long. So yeah, Sally, I think there's an opportunity here with this new government, and we should really grasp it.
Thank you, Pete. We've heard three very different focus points and perspectives. So I want to throw open a more general question to the three of you. And actually, it's two questions, but they're related. So I'll ask them together, and you choose how you want to respond. Mohammed, I'll come to you first, if that's okay. So we've heard about the language we use around tax, that it's a burden, that we need to look for havens and loopholes, that it's acceptable to get somebody to help you find ways to avoid it. How have you seen that ethos permeate and challenge our understanding of responsibility and unity? And then following on from that, what practical steps can we as individuals and faith communities take now to address tax justice? Mohammed.
Thank you, Sally. I think it's important to first start understanding why that has actually taken root. It's primarily to help avoid, you know, the kind of structural transformation that we require. The global economic architecture is currently set up to privilege the rich over the poor and the polluter over those who live in harmony with nature. And the more we even talk about new sources of finance, I think the important underlying question that doesn't get addressed is the rules of financing. The reality of the global economic architecture is that it wasn't designed by all of us. It wasn't designed for us. And so it's not a surprise that it won't be able to deliver the kind of, you know, transformation or just transition that is required today. And so I think the real partnership to fight for the kind of changes we want, whether it's climate justice or economic justice, the kind that will reposition us economically to be able to deliver the kind of strategic transformational interventions that are needed, can only come about if we truly internalize our interconnectedness. I think if we don't reformulate, you know, our conception of tax, I think the opportunity to help build the kind of global cooperation that is needed isn't going to be realized. Let me tell you and give you a concrete example. If you remember at the time when the Bretton Woods institutions were being built, the kind of, you know, transformation they brought to the world at that time, and specifically the example of the U.S. gifting the equivalent of 5% of its GDP at the time to help rebuild Western Europe, you know, the Marshall Plan, that wouldn't have been realized if the U.S. did not realize you know, its connectedness with Europe, and particularly Germany at that time. And if you also remember in the city of London, you know, the London Debt Accords of 1953 effectively cancelled 50% of Germany's external debt so that Germany can actually be welcomed back into the global, you know, system. And that is what helped drive, you know, the peace, prosperity of that Germany is enjoying. And that came about with a recognition of the importance of solidarity. What we don't have at the moment, and I think it's important for all of us to recognize, even though we talk about justice and we talk about global cooperation, is that level of global solidarity that helped secure those things in the past. And so I think it's important to recognize that the world we're in today, the reason we are not able to address climate change and deliver climate justice, or even mobilize sufficient finance, which we know is inexcusable, is largely not because there's no money. It's just because there's no sufficient international solidarity. And so I think that recognition perhaps will help us. So humanity is at a crossroads. We are near a tipping point on many issues, including climate justice. And the only thing that will help us is to think of what it will take to help rebuild trust. We are in a world of mistrust and suspicion. We can see the rising of the right wing in Europe, particularly Western Europe and in the US. We can see the division between the North and the global majority. And I think it's important to actually rethink what sort of a world we want and on what terms we build and what sort of economic system and architecture that is going to help us realize that. So that's my first intervention. So what can, you know, Christian Aid and all the good partners do? I think many of the solutions that we're looking for to help deliver climate justice, economic justice, tax justice are on the table today. And we must rapidly deploy, you know, the tools that we have. You know, the stuff we've talked about now, the windfall profit tax, is something we can easily, quickly deploy. You know, the fact that Christian Aid has been leading in fighting tax evasion and illicit transactions, those are things we can secure. The overhaul of the international finance architecture, and not just debt, reducing debt, but actually helping to avoid anything that will increase indebtedness in the global south, I think is something we can help achieve. So my appeal to all of us is to actually recognize that a lot of these things we're talking about and the solutions that we're looking for are actually available. It's just that we haven't built the politics to help us harness. And I think the more we invest in helping to build the politics, the more we can actually help mobilize sufficient support that is going to be required. If you look at our financial market, just one final example, there's so much money available on financial markets today. But that money isn't going to get into the people who require it to help protect our public good. And so what do we need to reduce debt, not just restructure it? What do we need to do to get more grants rather than loans, particularly for climate adaptation or for climate loss and damage actions? What can we do to help transfer, you know, the life-saving technologies via joint ventures so that we can deploy them to help decarbonize the entire world? That comes back to, are we human to each other? Do we extend kindness to each other? Do we see each other as equals? And do we work based on shared values to help live in a planet that we can be good stewards of if we have those shared values?
Thank you, Mohammed. And Sarah, I'm going to come to you next. Thank you.
Thanks, Sally. Yeah, this language around tax burden is really key. And obviously in the UK, we saw that most recently in the general election campaign, where it's just like a race to the bottom. You know, we have to reduce the tax burden. It's just the dominant narrative. And it's very difficult to challenge that. But it's really important that we do. We ran a project called Thanks for Tax, where we got people to vote for what they were most thankful for that tax is paid for. So people could say whether they preferred to vote for the NHS or for the education system or for welfare or for the environmental protections, just helping people make the connections. Mm-hmm. And we got some high profile bishops and faith leaders to sign on to a letter about giving thanks for tax. And that's a really important challenge to that language and that narrative that we all need to take. We have seen, as I mentioned, some glimmers of hope. The Green Party and the Liberal Democrat Party had some more positive things in their manifestos about taxing wealth more, and specifically a wealth tax from the Greens. But in the main parties, we're really struggling to see traction here. And it's really important that we do. We have this narrative about we've run out of money. We haven't run out of money. We're just not looking for it in the places where it's being held. We've talked about the extremes of inequality, and we need to really address that. So in terms of then practical steps, let's have conversations about tax. It's not an easy conversation. It's not an easy topic. We don't hear about it much in our churches, but we need to do that. We need to challenge that narrative. We need to talk about tax as a blessing, as a way that can fund our common life together, enable us to flourish, enable us to tackle the climate crisis and the cost of living crisis. And so practically at Just Money, we have an event every year called Tax Justice Sunday in June each year, where we resource churches to have services or small groups or Bible studies or sermons about tax. And we need to be doing that. It's part of our, as we've said, it's part of our faith response. It's a justice issue, and we need to be talking about it. Very, very practically, get in touch with your new MP. Ask them to support a wealth tax. We've got an action on our website that you can take if you want the sort of template letter. But just ask them, you know, what is it that they're going to do to support taxing wealth more? Internationally, the G20 summit is coming up in November. There's been this proposal for a global standard on taxing billionaires that Brazil, who are hosting the G20 this year, are supporting. So let's get behind that. Let's support. Let's ask Keir Starmer to go to Brazil and support a global standard on taxing billionaires. Why do we need billionaires if we've run out of money? We need to be taking the money from where it is and using it to fund the things that we all need to flourish on this one planet that we have.
Excellent. Thank you, Sarah. And Pete.
I'm just really encouraged by seeing all of you here today. It's a rainy, rainy day, and you could be a lot of other places. You could be sat still in your tent or your hotel, not getting rained on, or you could be somewhere else. But you've chosen to come here and to come to a session about tax, of all things. You know, you are in the vanguard of the people that we need to do something about the issues that we've talked about this morning. And I think we should draw encouragement to look around each other and think, you know, there's over 100 people here today in the rain coming to listen to these issues, to think about these issues and think, yeah, there's something that we can each do about it. And as Sarah said, you know, we can talk to our MPs about this, but I can tell you from experience of campaigning with Christian Aid over the last 4 or 5 years, when I talk to MPs, sadly what they say all too often is, we don't hear from churches very much anymore. We don't hear from you as much as we used to. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. Maybe that's an excuse. Maybe that's an excuse, right? Like, you know, politicians say all manner of things on occasion. But I don't think we should accept that. I think we need to be having these conversations with our MPs. And there are so many ways in which we can do that. I think Sarah's right that we need to be having these conversations in our churches. Just Money have got loads of great resources. So does Christian Aid. We started earlier this year a great new course called Act on Poverty, which we're doing, allying with domestic poverty organisations. So domestic and global poverty organisations coming together and saying, you know, let's talk about issues of poverty together. Because as Sarah said, they are connected. And if we're going to get action on domestic poverty, you know, we're also going to get action on global poverty, and they should not be pitted against each other. And I think we can see from the last 14 governments of the last 14 years of the last government that actually, you know, it was a lie when they said we need to cut spending on aid and development because that means we can spend more money on the issues at home, because it didn't happen, did it? You know, food bank use went up at the same time as we were cutting the 0.7% that should be spent on aid and development. So we have to use our voices. We need to talk to each other, use things like our Act on Poverty course at Christian Aid, but take that knowledge and discussion from each other out to our MPs. And so the really practical thing I want you to do this Greenbelt is, if you have not yet spoken to one of the Christian Aid team, got a postcard, signed it, and I think, Richard, it is going to MPs, isn't it?
Yes.
So if you do one thing, this Greenbelt, please, please, please do that. When you leave Greenbelt, please find an opportunity. Many of you, many of you will have new MPs. And we want them to be hearing about these issues. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to hear them saying to me, I'm not hearing from churches about this stuff because it matters too much.
Thank you. Excellent. Firstly, thank you so much to all three of you for persevering with the wee glitch, Mohammed for staying with us, and for the wealth of information that you have shared with us. We have a few minutes for any questions, and because you're all cozied in together, we may not be able to get a mic to you without stomping over people.
Just on tax avoidance, there are some that seem to be good tax avoidance, such as gift aid. Are you suggesting we don't gift aid any longer? Where is the line?
I've been asked this one before. We're not particularly campaigning against gift aid. Mm-hmm. What we're campaigning against is that, well, first of all, that stance that says, I need to pay as little tax as I can. It's something that's being taken away from me by some distant government, and this is my wealth. We need to, first of all, stop thinking in those terms. And second of all, we're campaigning against those specific ways of avoiding tax by the super rich individuals and businesses that are robbing our treasuries in the UK and around the world of billions of pounds of revenue to help tackle the climate crisis and the public service crisis and poverty crisis that we have here. But yeah, not particularly targeting gift aid in that.
Okay, thank you. Either anybody else want to come in on that one? Okay. Got another question.
Hi. I was really interested in thinking about the sort of global architecture of the economy that Mohammed spoke about. And my question has to do with, has there been any analysis done on what would happen to that architecture as a consequence of debt cancellation? So if we actually did that, what would actually happen? Because I've spoken to people working in sort of economy and so on, and then they talk about the fact that the pack of cards would actually just collapse. So I'm just asking, has there actually been an analysis done, a speculative analysis, because we know that's not going to happen, but we're pushing for it to happen. What would actually happen to the architectures of Western and global economies if that actually happened, given that we're a debt economy, as far as I understand it?
Thank you. Mohammed, would you like to comment on this one?
Yeah, I think the first thing to recognize is that we, because of the public crisis the world faces, the global, you know, governance system, including the global financial institutions that were established, I'll say more than eight decades ago, has been overwhelmed. I think this is the first thing for me to say. Because they were established for the past world 8 decades ago, they're currently unfit. They were actually established when majority of our countries, including those in Africa, had not gained independence. So they're no longer tenable for the global majority. And so if you truly want to have a system that works for the whole world, you can't afford to have incremental solutions. Those are not visible. In fact, to paraphrase, you know, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, we have no time for the tranquilizing drugs of gradualism, incrementalism, false solutions. You know, what we need is actually structural transformation, the kind that will deliver multi-pronged solutions that addresses the root causes of the poly crisis we currently face. So from an African perspective, I think you can cancel debt, but if you don't address the underlying root causes of Africa's indebtedness, which is climate, economic, you know, systems, that debt will be accumulated in short order. You know, there was a past, you know, cancellation of debt. And so what we're looking for here is, how do we ensure we do not feed the old economic engines of extravism and replace that with an economic engine for the kind of self-reliance, sustainability, prosperity, resilience? So this is the question I think that many of us are asking ourselves. And that requires real partnership. And so, as an African, I'm not just going to call for debt cancellation. if that is not going to be accompanied with global economic architecture that is fit, that is designed for all of us. And that is a question I think that is important for all of us to keep in mind. And then the final thing I'll say is, if you think about the cost of capital in Africa, and I think this is important for all of us to understand, it's 8 times more expensive to borrow if you're an African than if you're from the UK, for example. That feeds into a debt distress where you actually increase the debt burden of the continent. My own country, Kenya, currently uses 25% of our tax revenues to help service debt, 25%. Countries like Ghana are using more than 44%, Zambia 35%. This is the debt crisis majority of these countries are in. Now, your council don't address the underlying structural issues, that is going to then come back in a few years. So what we're looking for is how do we rebalance the system in a way that allows us to address the cost of capital, because when you look at Africa and compared to the rest of the advanced economies, cost of capital is far more, 5 times at least or more higher. And so these are the questions that underline, and it's also a recognition that the world we're in today is different than the world we were in 8 decades ago. And what is the opportunity for us to collectively recognize that world and make the substantial investment that is needed to help create a new world that mirrors who we are today in the world? And I think that's a question that we're looking for. And so it's not so much about debt cancellation today without addressing the underlying economic architecture and making sure that that architecture is fit to help us address the poly crisis we are in and allows us to deliver multi-pronged solutions for the different crises. I think this is a bigger challenge, and that is what doesn't get discussed a lot, because that is what it will take to help deliver a fairer global economic, a fairer global financial system, which we know is urgent and is needed, and it must be better than what we have today.
Thank you, Mohammed. Thank you. Probably got time for a couple of questions. And can I ask, after we have one question from the front, could the microphone please make its way to the back? Because I think it's been moved across, but not backwards. So we've got a lot of hands at the back. But we've got one question here, and then I'd ask it to move backwards.
The moral case for the introduction of a wealth tax for people with more than £10 million worth of assets is well made for climate action. But I'm just wondering whether there might be lower hanging fruit, not least because the people who you're seeking to tax are highly mobile and can afford excellent advisors. The lower hanging fruit may be potentially the housing wealth that we all have, at least middle-aged generation and elderly generation. We are alone in Western Europe in having an unlimited exemption for capital gains tax on the sale of our main residence. Plus, on death, if you have assets of less than £2 million, you can receive the residence nil rate band, thereby encouraging people to leave to their children the unearned wealth that they have built up during their lifetime. Buy land, they're not making any more of it. So my suggestion to you is that would it not be better if we tax us, the majority of people who are lucky enough to have had the unearned wealth building up on our balance sheets because of the increase in our housing wealth, rather than seeking to go after a group of people who will be extremely difficult to tax, not least in an environment where Rachel Reeves says it's never going to happen?
Okay, Sarah,
shall I go
for it.
So I think we would say it's both and. So some of the reforms I was talking about in terms of taxing wealth more include reforms to some of those loopholes around inheritance tax, for example, or not loopholes exactly, but reliefs. Sure. So some of the ways we can reform inheritance tax and we can reform capital gains tax could be ways of raising more revenue more fairly from the taxes that exist on wealth. We do need to, obviously, these are also, political decisions. So on the one hand, as you say, an actual wealth tax may feel like it's miles away, but, you know, if you talk to campaigners in the 90s, debt cancellation for poorer countries felt like a million miles away. So it's still worth calling for that, but it's also worth bearing in mind the political landscape, absolutely. But there are wealth taxes that work in other countries, and there are ways of trying to tackle capital flight. And there hasn't been, the research that's been done shows that most people don't move away from their country because of tax anyway, because they're here or wherever they are for other reasons to do with family and culture and schooling and all sorts of things. So that's a good myth to bust as well when we're thinking about how we take these things forward. But we would say absolutely reform existing taxes, but also let's call for a wealth tax too.
Okay. We've got time then for one more question, I think. So we've got at the back. Thank you.
A lot of tax is already spent on quite unjust things. So which needs to come first? Spending our taxes better and not on things like road subsidies, or creating a more just tax system that creates more tax that could in end just be spent on more horrible things that we wouldn't want our taxes on already?
Okay. Mohammed, did you want to come in on this one? Or
I will only say one small thing. I think we, in our toolbox, has a lot of good tools, so we can have access to a wide menu of options. And that menu could actually include redirecting some of those, you know, harmful subsidies that we're currently providing, and then cancelling some of the illegitimate debt, and then, you know, fighting tax evasion, because where I come from, I think tax evasion and illicit transactions is actually a bigger problem. And then in the UK, you know, using, you know, this wide menu, you know, strategically, so that you have a balanced, you know, a balanced bill at the end with cuts, new taxes, particularly of the wealthy. I think the thing I want to just end with, perhaps, because I have the opportunity now, is just a recognition that the richest 10% of the world are actually responsible for 50% of our global emissions. These folks face less than 3% of the climate-induced losses. And then you compare that to the poorest half of the world, who are responsible for less than 7% of the global emissions. But these people face 75% of climate-induced losses. So in such a global scenario, taxing the rich through a wealth tax, I think, is common sense. And I'm here, we're talking about the scale of the resources that are needed to help address a global challenge. So when you go now national, i.e. UK, then the choices may be different. But at a global level, I think we need just to recognize the sad reality of global climate inequality forces us to do things at the scale that allows us to deal with this crisis quickly.
Thank you. Thank you, Mohammed. I think We've run out of time, but I think that Sarah and Pete will be around a little while. So if you still have questions or you'd like to have a chat, I think that will be okay. But a huge thank you to Pete and to Sarah and to Mohammed for really sharing so much expertise, insight, and wisdom with us, and challenge. So thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.